Well, hello there, Wardville Community Church. It's Monday, July 25th, 2022. This is In the Know, episode 48. And I'm thinking I might need to rename this and start over with a new episode count, since we don't... Our mission statement is no longer leading people to know God. That was In the Know was kind of a play on that. I'm okay leaving it like it is, but it doesn't make as much sense. So maybe we should think about renaming that. If you have an idea for a name, I thought about the Community Brief. But if you have another idea, throw it out there. Or if you like that one, throw it out there. Or if you think this is silly, this is overblown, just do your thing, man. Just who cares? You can also let me know. My wife will probably be the one on that team. Few announcements before we jump into some sermon recap. July the 28th, Thursday night. We skipped a week. Last week was VBS. It was amazing. But this week is going to be the last ladies gathering, and it's going to happen at 6 p.m. at Bonnie Branham's house. So there's more information floating around the text message universe and on Facebook, and you can find that there. July the 31st, which is next Sunday, there's a going away party for Kate Rawls at 6 p.m. That's going to be at Kevin and Ronnie Williams's house. They've asked if you want to swim, just bring a beach towel. And they're asking people to bring a savory party food. And it'd probably be best to let Ronnie know what you're bringing so that we don't have five people bring buffalo chicken dip, as good as that would be. Yes, someone should make buffalo chicken dip. I totally agree with you. I know that's what you're thinking. That's what I was thinking. Middle of August at some point, the date is still to be determined. We're going to have an initial meeting of our security team who will discuss the development of protocols, policies, procedures for our church. If you're interested in being part of that, you can reach out to me or to my brother-in-law, Heath Henskins. August the 21st is going... I almost said August 21st. August the 21st is our evening service at 5 p.m. And then this Sunday... or next Sunday, whatever, the very next one we meet, we're going to be going through Genesis 48. And I can't believe it. We are like 4 weeks away, 5 weeks away, something like that, from finishing Genesis. So I have four sermons left. So three in August and one in July. And then the last week of August, the 28th, would be a Genesis recap, where we'll look through a lot of the book and read through a lot of the events of the book and take away some major lessons. And so, Lord willing, by the end of August, we're going to be finished with the book of Genesis. Isn't that crazy? So that will be happening shortly. So let's do a little bit of sermon recap. I've got four major sections for you, and each of them have to do with something in the sermon. Okay, let's talk be fruitful and multiply. These are words that appear especially throughout the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, but they also appear in Genesis 47, though it's not in the form of a command. Genesis 47:27 says, the people of Israel, in brackets, it's like they, but I'm giving you who it is, the referent that it's talking about, were fruitful and multiplied greatly. These words root us back in Genesis 1:28, where God, after making male and female, blesses them and commands them to be fruitful and multiply. This is often called the creation mandate. And we know mandate means command. God reiterates it to Noah and his family after the flood in Genesis chapter 9, verse 1. God also promises to Abraham, and well, at that time he was Abram, when this is spoken to him. And at that time, he has exactly zero children. God promises him in Genesis 17, verses 1 through 6, that he will make him exceedingly fruitful. I think he also says at times he's going to multiply them, or they're going to have a multitude of offspring. When Isaac finally gets some land, and an uncontested right to a well, he says Yahweh has made room for us and we shall be fruitful in the land. Genesis 26:22. As Isaac sends Jacob away to Padan Aram, he does so with this blessing: God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may become a company of peoples. That's Genesis 28, verse 3. God Almighty gives this command directly to Jacob in Genesis 35, 11. And then Joseph gives Ephraim his name, saying, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. Genesis 41, 52. So I give all of those, I say all of that to say that when you see Genesis 47, 27, those words didn't come from nowhere. They're profound, significant, important, weighty words that have a history with the people of God. They point both to the command of God and to his blessing that fulfills the command. Genesis 46, 3 doesn't actually contain the same words, fruitful and multiply, but the same idea is present in the form of a promise. In Egypt, God will multiply Israel greatly. Jacob has so in Genesis 28, he receives it in the form, like these words, in the form of a blessing. In Genesis 35, he receives it in the form of a command. And then if it's the same idea, which it is, then in Genesis 46, he receives it in the form of a promise. And so in the midst of this famine, when both Canaan and Egypt are ruined, God allows for the fruitfulness and for the immense multiplication of his people in the land of Egypt. Here is the blessing of God at work in his chosen family. You can't economize your way around death. Economizing, as we said yesterday, seeking maximum utility or satisfaction with limited resources. Economizing is perhaps a helpful way to think about buying decisions and, to an extent, time expenditures. For the people of God, though, it is not the only lens through which we evaluate purchases, expenditures of time, or even actions. We operate primarily on a moral plane rather than a materialistic, pragmatic plane that seeks only maximum utility and satisfaction. In other words, we aren't worried quite so much about maximizing utility as we are about maximizing obedience to God and love toward others. So we have to include those factors in whenever we talk about economizing. And beyond that, we must also bear in mind that as much as we might seek to economize to deal with the problem of scarcity that's a result of the fall, there is no way to economize to such an extent that we avoid death. It is the ultimate limitation upon humanity, right? Our time will run out. It is limited not only by the hours in the day, but by the span of our lives. Our money, then, at death, will pass to someone else. Our possessions are inherited by our family after we die. We will leave plans unrealized, projects unfinished, and desires unfulfilled. These bodies will eventually wear out on us, and food won't taste, or we won't be able to hear or see or smell or sense in the way we once did. Death affects us all, and death comes to us all. So yes, we should economize, but we ought not forget that the ultimate limitation awaits. It is both certain and uncertain. As a fact, it is certain, but the details and circumstances surrounding it are a mystery known only to God. The reality is, economizing, therefore, isn't the fix, even for the problem of scarcity. That's the argument that I'm trying to make. What is the fix? Well, it's the ultimate solution for the ultimate problem of sin and death, Christ. That's who we really need, even more than being a rational consumer. Let me give a word on entitlement now. One thing I thought was really interesting about our text is the gratitude the people of Egypt showed for having sold everything they owned. I couldn't help but wonder what would happen if this famine occurred today in the United States. See, I'm afraid we've come to expect far too much of our government, and some of us, and I don't mean us necessarily in our church, but and maybe, but I mean us Americans, have grown far too dependent upon the government. Let me be clear. I'm thankful for the rule of law and our government that is of the people, by the people, and for the people. I think governments are at their very best when they serve the people they represent rather than use and or abuse them. But in every form of government, there are always, because we live in a fallen world, unintended consequences. Perhaps because of the way our government operates with elected officials, right? Some people, like, it's good that we elect officials and that there are term limits, right? That's a good thing. But perhaps some people might sneak in with a desire to stay in power more than to serve the people. And so to stay in power, which is really self-serving, not people-serving, they sometimes cater to the whims of the people rather than actually leading them, which I'm saying that would be serving them, is to lead them best. And this could become an expectation in the people's mind that the government will give them what they want or do what they want. Now, this could lead to a sense of entitlement, so that the true and good phrase, "the government works for the people," becomes actually a prideful, sneering statement. "You work for me." I see a deep sense of entitlement within our culture today, where many people believe that the government is responsible for protecting their health, ensuring that they have a job, providing for the income if they don't have a job, and codifying into law whatever we deem are fundamental human rights, rather than recognizing God-given human rights and protecting those. Where is our sense of personal responsibility? Where is our sense of duty to go out, get a job, and provide for those we love? We need people. Our culture needs people who will step up and do whatever is necessary and honest for their families to eat. The people of Egypt, to be sure, lived under a different form of government. So, like, there's one distinction between us and them. But look at their sense of responsibility. They don't just come to Joseph and demand grain. They expect that it will cost them something, and they are prepared to pay for it because they recognize life is more valuable. And when, at the end of this whole spiral, they have nothing left except their own lives, they are grateful to Joseph for providing for the survival of their nation. I just think if Genesis 47's famine were to happen today, I fear we would see people demonstrating in the streets, demanding that the government simply give them money or food or jobs for nothing in return. They would say, "We have a right to these things, and the government exists to make sure we get them." I want to be careful not to take too much out of these verses, but I just, again, as I was reading, I was struck by the sense of personal responsibility and gratitude that these people have simply to have been kept alive. We would do well, therefore, to emulate their sense of personal responsibility and gratitude rather than entitlement. Let me talk briefly about preparing for death. I want to give what I believe is a little practical wisdom. So, of course, the most important way that any person can prepare for death is to be reconciled to God through Christ. And as a believer, being ever nearer to Christ and walking in ever closer fellowship with Him daily will help prepare us to meet Him face to face. There's also a book written fairly recently. I'll link to it. It's called Remember Death. Perhaps this would be a helpful read for some of us. I would argue probably for all of us. But there are also practical ways to prepare for death, especially for those who have spouses and children. Since death is certain, but the timing is uncertain, it isn't wrong and is actually prudent to have a life insurance policy that will help your family pick up the financial pieces when you die, if you die before your working years are over. Since death is certain, it isn't wrong and is actually prudent to have a last will and testament that directs your family about how to pay for your funeral expenses and to distribute the property you own, as well as to gain important or access to important accounts, financial especially. And it also isn't wrong and is actually prudent to have a living will that specifies how far you want doctors or physicians to go in medical care to keep you alive so that your family is kept from having to make agonizing decisions that could be the cause of regret later. Perhaps your family will never have to use an insurance policy. Prayerfully, they won't. Perhaps your last will doesn't matter in the next 30 years. Prayerfully, it won't. Perhaps your living will won't ever be used. Prayerfully, it won't. But given the uncertainty that we all face about how and when death will happen, coupled with its certain fixed inevitability, these measures are a way for us to provide and even to lead in the aftermath of our death. I know that those aren't the most encouraging, happy thoughts, but I do pray that we all prepare well for that moment. And in the meantime, have a great week. I love you, people.